applicant from Cameroon, who has only been identified as HT, has been told that he should relocate elsewhere in his country and be more discreet in the future. He has been attacked by an angry mob at home after being seen kissing his partner. He has been fighting removal from the UK for the past 4 years. HT and the applicant from Iran, where homosexual acts are punishable by death, will now have the case reviewed by immigration tribunals.
Those are some of the headlines from the continent for this week. You are listening to CHRY 105.5. Welcome back to CHRY 105.5. You are listening to African Perspectives, your source for timely news and in-depth views from the continent. Today's topic is sexuality in Africa. Now we're going to get started with our interview with Sikari Ikini. Sikari is a Nigerian queer blogger and activist. Her well-known blog, Black Looks, you can find it at www.blacklooks.org, engages with issues of social justice and activism in Africa and the diaspora. Through the blog, she works to challenge stereotypes by documenting and discussing issues such as LGBTIQ rights and sexual orientation, gender-based violence, militarism, as well as popular culture and literature from Africa. Here's our interview with Sikari. Let's start off by talking about the discourse of or narrative of African sexuality in the mainstream, be it mainstream media, general public. Could you tell us a bit about that?
The first thing I'd say is that I don't see these as being particularly different than in other parts of the world. Yeah, there are socioeconomic, cultural, religious contexts, but essentially the dominant discourse around sexuality is similar to in other places, and it's sort of patriarchy, heteronormativity. Probably more specific to the continent is the assumption that there are no LGBTI people in Africa. And then again, strong masculinities, which are played out through a kind of macho nationalism with notions of family and return to the traditional values. And I think one way in which the mainstream, largely white, middle class in the UK, have LGBT community in the UK have dealt with this is call to a return to family and traditional values is through mainstreaming themselves through a process of homonormativity. And I think this, so these things are played out in the West in slightly different ways, but at the same time they are not so different from what is actually taking place on the continent.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are some of the major factors that help construct this discourse? Like African sexualities, for instance, as being like non-existent on the continent?
Again, I think it's difficult. I think, you know, I would like to think that, I would say that the factors are pretty much the same across the world. You have a growing right-wing reactionary media. You have an equally right-wing religious fundamentalism. This is very much present in the United States, but it's also growing across the African continent. In fact, it's one of the largest growth industries, is Christian religious fundamentalism. And this is especially in countries like Uganda, Malawi, Nigeria, and South Africa. So you have that. Then you have this scapegoating of vulnerable people, which is a way of deflecting from issues such as high unemployment, poverty, and so on and so forth. Here in the West, that is the scapegoats, particularly in the United States, in the UK, in Germany, are immigrants, particularly Muslim immigrants. In parts of Africa, it's LGBTI people. They are un-African. It is un-African. We don't want them. And it's the same thing in Europe. It's immigrants. Do you see the connecting points? So you have this focus of hate, which is placed on different sectors, sections of the community, depending where you are and depending, you know, who is the most vulnerable at a in a particular location at a particular time.
You mentioned Malawi, and I guess I want to move into a case that came out of Malawi that made headlines all over the world this year. The case of Stephen Mongeza, I'm probably butchering their names, and Tiwong Chimbalanga. Can you tell us a bit about that case?
The couple were arrested and charged with unnatural sexual acts in Malawi under the penal code, which was left over actually from the British colonial rule, which relates to sodomy. Now, the couple were eventually charged and sentenced to, I think it was 14 years in prison with hard labor. After a lot of pressure from the international community, so we hear, and within Africa as well, the Prime Minister of Malawi pardoned the couple. And there's two things which I think are quite important with the case. The one is in terms of the legal issue. Sibongile Nadashi, who's a human rights lawyer, wrote a piece on my blog, Black Looks. And the points she raised, I think, are the important ones. And that is, how does the pardon from international pressure, how does that impact on the sovereignty and autonomy of African states and their legal processes? And one of the issues is, first of all, I would say that we're all extremely relieved that Stephen and Tiwonge are no longer in prison and are free today. However, nothing has changed in Malawian law. There has not been a challenge which could have been challenged under appeal. Do you see where I'm going?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if the case had gone to appeal, it's quite possibly that it could have been overturned with arguments in law. So what has happened? There's been this intervention in the legal process which has prevented the legal process from taking its due course and coming out with an outcome that could possibly have actually changed Malawian law and decriminalized or altered it in some way. But because of the intervention, this has not taken place. So there's huge questions around that issue. And, you know, for how long will we in Africa be blackmailed over aid? That if we don't do this, we won't get aid. And if we don't do that, we won't get it. But if we do this, if we buy arms, we will get aid. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one point. And I think the second point actually relates to gender identity. And as I understand it, at the initial time of the arrest of Stephen and Tiwongi, they were both identified in the media, both in Malawi and Africa internationally, as a gay couple. But later we learned that Tiwongi identified as a trans woman. So that is also quite significant because it shows how there's a conflating of gay and trans, that is sexual orientation and gender variance or identity, on the one hand, and also the fact that transgender people are being seen as gay and as being seen as homosexual. So that's another issue that I think came out of the case. So, yeah, those are the two, I think, most important things that have not actually been discussed in the media.
How has the media portrayed this this case?
I think they've portrayed it similarly to how Africa is portrayed in general, which is as a single story, as a kind of, in terms of the West being this kind of modern, traditional place, as opposed to, the West has been modern and Africa has been this traditional. They've presented it in this kind of binary of modern and traditional, backward and enlightened way in which Africa is always presented. I mean, the dominant discourse in the West in relation to Africa has always been in terms of them and us, traditional and modern, which is something that I think has grown out of the colonial, is one of the colonial legacies. And it's a discourse and an assumption that Africa has not changed, that the West has changed. But, you know, everywhere in the world, the traditional and modern binary coexist side by side. And in some ways, yeah, this can be fluid, and depending on the situation where the situation or location, it can be used against the other as a political and a religious tool. And I think this happens quite a lot, both on the continent and in the West. For example, the British government, I live in London, the British government, both the present British government and past British government, over the last, I would say, 10, 15, maybe 20 years even, has always constantly harped on about going back to the notion of traditional values, i.e. heteronormative values of coupling and Protestant worth ethics. Again, these are used to attack the vulnerable in homophobic, racist, and anti-immigrant ways. So we have the connection between the traditional values in this sense and family values, which immigrants and, let's say just immigrants, particularly Muslims, challenge those traditional British family values. So this whole thing about traditional and modern, it's something that is taking place. And it goes back to what I said earlier about scapegoating vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. In the West, it's immigrants. At this moment in time, it's particular immigrants, Muslim immigrants. And in Africa, it's LGBTI people. I think that's how the case was reported.
What would you say the impact of the West's history in Africa has been on the construction of dominant discourses of sexuality?
The reason I'm hesitating is because this is a complicated and complex question, and the answer is not something that you can be reduced to a few sentences. But I'll just briefly say something about the factors that I think have impacted. And I would say slavery, the legacy of colonialism, which is still here today, as I've referred to previously, the demonization of black sexuality, the black man as the uncontrollable predator, the black woman as the insatiable woman engaging in perverse sexual acts, as perceived by Victorian, you could think of Sarah Bartman, for example. The black body being seen still as subjected to this perverse gaze, objectified and sexualized and denigrated. So I think all of those have contributed. But also, it's about the destruction of local knowledge, the destruction of languages, imposition after imposition after imposition, the exploitation of resources, which has been going on since slavery, at the expense of African people, neocolonialism, the militarization of these, and again, militarization goes right back because the colonial project was also a military project, and this continues within neocolonialism today. I mean, there was points in times, not just in Africa, but in throughout the world, where there had been periods of radicalism, the independence movements, for example, the independence movements, the wars against apartheid, the war in Mozambique and Namibia. There have been these periods of radicalism, but I would say that where we are now, there has been this co-option and there's a reactionary politics which is taking place, which itself is highly militarized and xenophobic, and this is something that is taking place everywhere. And again, the thing is, what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of similarities. The differences are not so much. The differences come out of racist perceptions of Africa. So if there was a case earlier this week when a headless body was found in Uganda, and this was reported as being a gay activist, however, it turned out that this was a hoax. It was reported as a hoax. I would say that it was irresponsible reporting not to check out the story in the first place. But I went to a number of websites and looked at the comments, and there were some very, very racist comments. And one, for example, stuck out in my mind, which described this action and Ugandans as being savage. But how many headless bodies? I know there have been headless bodies being found in England. There have been mass murders in the United States, in Britain, in Germany, in parts of Europe. I can't say about Canada. But when these same things happen here, nobody leaves comments about the British or the Americans or the Germans being savages. So it's the racism, it's how Africa is perceived and how there is this single story around the continent. We don't see the complete picture. What we see in the media is images of crazed pastors spewing hate. The gay media in the West reports continuously about the Ugandan bill, which is horrific, which is horrible. But what it doesn't do, it doesn't report the other side of the story. So Africans are perceived as being passive and unquestioning. Why are we not shown these other stories? Why are they not there to be read? You know, we're being made invisible. And if we're not being made invisible, we're being made derogatory. So, you know, there's a lot to do with perceptions and representations, and which are racist. Because at the end of the day, there's so much positive activism that is taking place on the continent. And if we focus, if the media were to look at the positive, focus on the positive and progressive, which even by, I have to say, by European and American standards is particularly progressive, then we would see other stories coming out instead of this one single story.
So we saw with the Western feminist movement that feminism was used to justify a certain kind of imperialism, wherein white women thought it was their duty and right, to paraphrase Gayatri Spivak, to save brown women from brown men. Do you see something like this do you see something like this playing out in anti-homophobia or LGBTIQ movements internationally, specifically directed at Africa or anywhere in the global south?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities with the Western feminist movement, which I would like to say continues today. The gay imperialist movement, I think, which is, in my opinion, desperate to be seen as liberators of the African queer, with the ideas of imposing, again, it's about imposition. It's impositions of values, of ideas. It's a kind of colonizing project or mission, which I have to say is also very unprogressive and very homonormative and full of contradictions. So yes, I do think that is taking place. And I think that it's why we need to be wary of it, wary of the misinterpretations and misrepresentations which come out of this desire to liberate us from ourselves, is that it actually compromises struggles on the continent, struggles and actions by activists on the front line. It also, again, goes back to what I've just said about the single story. It ignores and it silences the voice of Africans themselves. So again, we don't hear any African voices in this gay imperialism. I often read that such and such an organization, like, say, Outrage, has been working with activists or with people in Malawi or in Nigeria. But who are these people? Mm-hmm. There are so many activists, there are so many organizations, such as SMUG, such as Hoka in Rwanda. SMUG is in Uganda. Mm-hmm. GALC in Kenya. Changing Attitudes in Nigeria. There are so many organizations and activists working on the ground in frontline activities. So, and they're all out. They're not hiding. So who are these invisible people that they are working with? I don't understand it. So I don't know. I just get the feeling there's a certain degree of divide and rule. There was an incident some years back when about 20 African organizations and individuals made a statement calling on Peter Tatchell of Outrage for people not to work with him because he was damaging people, the struggle, and he was acting on his own without in consultation with local activists and therefore causing them even more problems and putting them at even more risk. So that was taking place. And the response from that was very interesting because the response was that he was working with unknown people who were progressive and all of us who signed this document were reactionary group of people, and they were not quote unquote the real authentic activists. So that was the response, and that response was given an African voice, which was even more how could I put it, cunning, that's what the way I would say it. So yes, I think there is that same kind of movement that was taking place in terms of the feminists in the 70s and 80s, which, as I said, is still taking place today in different ways.
What do you think we can do to challenge this gay imperialism, or I like what you said in an email, pink colonialism?
I think the way we're challenging this is by the fact that we are already speaking, we are already organizing. Mm-hmm. And yes, we have to, we are visible on the continent, but we are being denied that visibility through this pink colonialism, which has access to media here in the West. So I think one of the ways to counter that is to build allies in the West within the progressive queer movement here in the United States and Canada and Europe. And I think that this is beginning. I mean, there's one example I was just trying to think of, and the recent banning of the in the Pride March in Toronto mm-hmm. of the Queers Against Apartheid, a number of activists in the Global South who had previously been given awards by Toronto Pride in different years returned their awards in an act of solidarity both with the Queers Against Israeli Apartheid and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And I think that's the way we should be going. We should be moving away from a single issue and building allies within progressive movements, both on the continent, which I think is already being done. So there's a building of a movement between the different countries. So it's we have a Pan-African movement as well as national and regional movements. And internationally, we begin to build solidarity with very progressive, anti-racist, anti-Islamophobia, pro-Palestinian, pro-land rights, rights to the city, all these kind of movements. If we then build solidarity with those kinds of groups, I think that's one way. But I think another way is of challenging this is that I would say we have to be listened to. Our voices have to be heard. And if we focus on some of the very progressive, groundbreaking work that is being done, for example, activists like transgender activist Victor Mukasa. I sent you a couple of videos. Academic activists, Sylvia Tamale from Uganda, who's done incredible work and put incredible risks on their families and their lives. Visual activists, groundbreaking work by photographer Zanelli Moholi, who has been documenting black lesbian lives. The work of cultural activist Gabrielle LaRue, who has done a lot of work with transgender activists in her Portraits and Stories project, which is being exhibited. There's so much going on that it isn't even happening here in the West. These are really groundbreaking actions that are taking place. So those need to be recognized, and we need to focus on those. And yes, there are serious, serious issues around sexual freedom, around criminalization, which we want to have international solidarity with people. We want to work with people outside, but we don't want to work in such a way that our voices are not heard, and it reduces it to a single issue in terms of rights or agendas that are not necessarily at this moment in time the most important agenda for us. For example, is gay marriage, is that the most important thing? I don't think so, not at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. There are far more pressing issues that we need to be dealing with, not just in Africa, but you know, in globally. So I think those are some of the ways in which we can challenge the pink colonialism and these perceptions of passivity and these racist perceptions of Africa, where only the single story is told, the multiple stories, the other pictures are not seen.
That's all the questions I have for you. Do you have any comments to end off with?
I would like to end up, I just need to find it, with a quote from transgender activist Victor Mokasa. Victor made this comment in regards to his portrait, which I just spoken of. He writes, "Transgender Africans have been silenced for a long time. We have been invisible as though we did not exist. Today, many of us speak, we show our faces, we write, and we express ourselves openly." He goes on to say, I felt lost, but my transgender niece and nephew will not feel lost. They will look at my portrait and will gain power and hope and peace and pride from looking at my portrait. And that's how I'd like to end.
Thank you so much, Zakari. That was our interview with Zakari Ikhini. If you're interested in her work, please check out her amazing blog, www.blacklooks.org.
And right before we go to community listings, we're going to listen to Petit Pays and a song called Le Pédé. And Pédé is a bit of a colloquial term that's used in a lot of French West African countries. Petit Pays is from Cameroon. It's a colloquial term kind of used to signify a homosexual person. A bit derogatory, but a word that has been reclaimed to use in the homosexual community. So he wrote this song as a response to the negative attitude in Cameroon to homosexuality. And he is asking, what's wrong with difference?
C'est bon, ça choque les autres, ça vient. déranger.